The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Margot Lennigan, and you're listening to The Guardian Children's Books Podcast.
I'm Melvin Burgess. I'm going to be reading from my book, Doing It. But first of all, over to Margot, and she's going to be reading from her lovely book, Tender Morsels.
Thank you, Melvin. Tender Morsels is a retelling of the Grimm's fairy tale, Snow White and Rose Red. I'm going to be reading a section from where something terrible is about to happen to the main character, Liga. She's living in a cottage in the forest with her baby, and she is all alone, and some boys from the village come along to visit her. The first she heard of the lads was their voices up at the road. There was a burst of rough laughter as they rounded the hill. Three of them, maybe more. Then they quietened suddenly, as if hushed by someone. She knew that laughter. It was the noise of boys showing off for each other, boys with heavy voices and eyes that didn't properly look at you. She'd a distant memory of that noise, in the market in town, as she walked with her mother. "Come," said Mam, "we'll walk through the cloth hall while they pass." "Come," said Liga now, and picked the baby up out of the truckle and stood listening. They were coming down the path to the house. They could not keep silent, there were too many of them, and some wanted to show the others that they didn't care to be hushed. They slapped their feet down and grunted. One of them hawked and spat, another hissed a remonstration and was snarled at. Liga crept to the chimney piece, fast, silent. She took out the loose stone and the key from behind it and crossed to the wooden store chest. She opened it, laid the baby on the cloths inside, closed it, locked it. She hid the key, and there they were, clear of the trees, five of them, all large except for that runtish boy, cockily leading. The woodchopper's son was there, that foreigner's boy was there. She remembered asking Mam, of his even darker father, "Why has he all sooted up his face?" And Mam had shushed her. This she saw as she dragged the door closed. On seeing her, they started to run. That little one shot towards her, but she got it done. She dropped the latch just as he banged into the door from the other side. She gasped and jumped back. Coldly, she thought, "You should have run for the trees." They threw themselves at the door. Terrible things, they were shouting. They were not sensible. They were in a kind of frenzy. Nothing would stop them. Not door, not latch, not wall. She understood not to shout back or to cry out in fear. They would enjoy her shouting. It would whip them up worse. She sat silent beside the chest in the corner, trying to disappear. Their heads came to the window and shouted there and joked and crooned. Their laughter bounded about in what was once her home, which had been cosy and safe until just a little while ago, but now was spindly as a birdcage, fragile as a fay lamp on its dried stalk under a bush. She had never felt the house to be fragile before, not even in the wildest storm. But now it seemed made of leaf matter or smoke, and the boys' arms waved in the window like May ribbons loose from their pole. They pulled out the window frame. They started to break pieces off around the window. Liga put her hand on the wooden chest. "I will come back for you," she said to the child inside, and she climbed up into the chimney. She thought of herself going nimbly up and out the top. She had done it before, dropping off the edge of the soft thatch, running, losing them in the forest, listening to them disperse, disappointed. Instead, she found her shoulders wedged and no way to turn them so as to fit through. She looked up and saw the chimney cover and a wink of sky. The boys thudded into her house. Their voices funneled up to her. She reset a slipping toe and a stone came loose and carried soot down to the dead hearth. "She's up the chimney! Can you see? Is she out the top?" A voice came suddenly loud up the chimney. "I can see! I can see right up her, right up the crease of her. Come, sweet one, bring down that little purse to me. I shall count every coin you have in it. Light a fire! Smoke her out! She'll be the stubborn sort. She'll die up there of smoke rather than tumble down. We'll have her then. You want a roast, go buy your feck meat from Sweetbread and Sons. Fox, you go up. You're littlest. Yes, Fox, you're perfect for the job. With this new shirt, my man would kill me. Take it off, man. May as well be naked now as later, eh? Must I? Go on. We'll let you have first go of her." In the silence, Liga pushed her shoulders up against the obstruction. Turned, pushed. Soot went dancing down. "She have not gotten out the top yet, have she? Shut up and listen." They shut up. "Look up there, Fox." "I can see her in there," said Fox. "I can hear her breathing. She is trapped."
Thank you very much, Margot. Now, something quite different. We've got Melvin reading from his book club book, Doing It. Over to you, Melvin.
Hello there. Doing It is a book that I wrote a few years ago, feeling that although there were loads and loads of books for girls about relationships and sex and so forth, there were not very many for boys, and particularly for that aspect of sexual culture among boys, which is perhaps a little bit rude and perhaps a little bit jokey and not very touchy-feely, and it tends to be rather frowned upon in public. And it was kind of, you know, because I found all that stuff very, very funny and touching when I was that age, so I decided to write about it, no holds barred, to try and show that actually, you know, filth is kind of all right, really. Now, this book's about three characters. This is Jonathan, who's finally started to go out with his girlfriend, and he's very anxiously looking forward to sleeping with her, but he's got a fear about his private bits. He's got a bit anxious about it, and he's not talking about it here, but he's talking about how foolish he feels and some of the things that he's worried about and some of the things that he was worried about in the past in his early sexual experiences. So this is Jonathan talking about secrets. Secrets. I have thousands of them milling about in the dirty black hole of my psyche, although nothing as awful as the one Mr. Nobby must never know. For instance, this is an interesting one. I bet loads of people have this one, but they never dare admit it. When I was 14 and going out with my first girlfriend, I couldn't find her fanny. How about that? I mean, I know. How is it possible to miss something like that? It's about 2 feet long when you get close off. Impossible to miss, you'd think. But I did. Her name was Lucy Small, in the same year as me, and she picked me up. The only thing that I ever picked was my nose on a school geology trip to Wales. Your first girlfriend and you meet her in Wales. That's humiliating enough, surely. We went for a walk to post some letters and then went to hide ourselves among the trees by the roadside for some heavy petting. She'd been after me for a while, but I'd been too shy. She'd gone out with Adrian Noble to post letters the night before, and he came back into the camber and made it all sniff his finger to show that he'd been there. She only did it to make me jealous. So, I felt her tits. See? I'm not a complete idiot. I knew where they were. And then she undid the button to her jeans, and I put my hand down and down, and it wasn't there. Nothing. I was amazed. What was going on? Was she deformed? Had I been lucky enough after all this time to finally get a girlfriend, and she has no fanny? Should I say something sympathetic? Oh dear, no fanny. That's a stroke of bad luck, isn't it? Or was I making some sort of mistake? Well, that seemed the most likely, so I scratched about her bush, up and down, all around. No doubt about it. No fanny. Amazing. Well, it was obviously cobblers. Even I could see that. What about Adrian Noble's finger? Perhaps I'd found it there already, but it was completely different from what I'd thought. Or maybe there was some secret way of opening it up. Open sesame, you know, a flap or a button or something. Whatever. There had to be some explanation. So, the next night, me and Lucy, we took another walk and went into the bushes, and I thought, I'm really going to have a look this time. But exactly the same thing. No fanny. I scratched around for ages. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't ask her, could I? Excuse me, where's your fanny? I know you have one. Adrian Noble made that very clear, but I need to know where it is. Not possible. So that's when I got really dirty and I started feeling around in a more adventurous fashion. Further down, she didn't mind. Somewhat to my surprise. I mean, that was bum territory as far as I was concerned. I knew that girls were supposed to enjoy having their fannies felt, but even that felt a bit doubtful. Although I suppose if she didn't have a fanny, her bum might be the next best thing. So anyway, I pushed further around and down and I found bits, fleshy bits. I probed, I felt, and then suddenly right down there, I mean right down there, practically up her arse, there it was. She let out a little gasp as I found my way in. Bingo! So that's where she keeps it. Amazing! But how embarrassing for those two girls, having your private parts about half an inch away from your dirt box. Planning? I mean, who thought of that? It isn't even hygienic.
Thank you, Melvin. And last night, when you read that same section as part of your Edinburgh Festival event, I think there were quite a lot of knowing and embarrassed laughs from the boys and the men in the audience. And I think you said this did actually come from one of your own experiences.
It came from a few experiences. I mean, I actually had that experience. You know, I at 14, first girlfriend, I'd seen the diagrams, I'd even seen pornography, but somehow or other it didn't... It didn't prepare me. Of course, because you see your willies on the front, so you naturally assume that a girl's private parts are on the front as well. You don't realise that it's sort of right underneath. And then when you see people having sex, their bum sort of goes up and down, not to and fro. So it's all rather confusing, really.
It certainly is. As you'll have heard there, your books have very, very different styles, but one thing that they do both have in common is that they both caused quite a lot of controversy when they were first published. I wonder if you could tell me a bit about that and the reaction and how you felt about that. I think Margot.
Well, it was the Daily Mail put out a rather hysterical article, which was, I think the headline went something like, rape, incest, bestiality. Is this what children should be reading? And I think they were rather looking to make it into as big a story as they could, and they did this by conflating children's and young adult literature. So, of course, this is not what children should be reading or would understand if they read. But this was never a book that was written for teens. So it wasn't as if it was even really very upsetting for me, because it wasn't even an honest misunderstanding of the book. It was a sort of a willful miscasting of the book in the wrong demographic from the one it was intended to appeal to. And in the end, it was ultimately very good for the book, because it drew attention to it and made people really look at it and read it for themselves and work out exactly how their boundaries were drawn in relation to it. So it was, in the end, a good thing.
In my case, I'd had some controversy about books before, and so I was anticipating some controversy. But what I wasn't anticipating was that the Children's Laureate at the time, Anne Fine, should take the trouble of writing a ringing condemnation of this book. She took out half a page in The Guardian, absolutely tearing it to pieces, tearing everyone who had anything to do with it to pieces, demanding that it be pulped, claiming that it was pure filth and that it would put girls off dating for life. So there was a great deal of controversy, and I was very anxious about it, because she's quite a powerful piece of work, Anne. But when I read the piece, I was much reassured, because it was it wasn't an argument, really. She was just horrified and disgusted. But I always felt that, even when I was quite young, I could remember that "you dirty little boy" thing. And I think, well, you know, it's a book. You don't have to read it. You can put it down if you want. And it's for, you know, boys and for girls who want to perhaps find out about boys. It is truthful. It is funny. I think the boys are actually nice lads and charming lads, despite their obscene sense of humour. And, although the book did acquire quite a lot of attacks from people like Anne, and also from the Daily Mail, always get this stuff in the Daily Mail, who more or less make their headlines up sometimes. But it also got a lot of support from women as well as men. In the end, the controversy caused some great good, because, of course, it made the book sell far more copies. But to this day, I occasionally get people who sort of say, "Oh, I thought you were that dreadful man who wrote that dreadful book. But I read it the other day, and it wasn't at all what I expected." So it's always a bit of a two-edged sword, controversy.
In case you're wondering what the background noise is, the heavens have opened over Edinburgh. It's a deluge is coming down, and the sun has also just come out, so I think there's going to be a wonderful rainbow. Over to a question from Guardian teen books like member Lydia, who wants to know what sparked you to push past the criticisms and publish doing it when it was such a controversial book. Why did you want it to be out there?
Very often when you're writing books for people younger than yourself, you're looking back at that time of your life and you're thinking about the books you'd want to read and about the kind of books I'd want to read now, and I just felt that it was a gap. You know, the adult world was and still is, to a large degree, very anxious about teenagers, and that transition from being sort of child to adult with, you know, sexual feelings and relationships and, you know, deciding to go out on your own and get drunk and do all the things that adults do. Adults find it very anxious making. They find it hard to let go. They find it hard to talk to people about it. So I wanted to try and write a truthful book about that culture amongst boys, because they in particular don't get served very well. People are particularly anxious. I mean, they're anxious enough about girls' sexuality, but boys' sexuality is very often like, ugh! You know, it's this nasty, slimy thing which really ought to be kept out of sight. So I just wanted to say, you know, it is all right and it's fine and it's enjoyable, and it's a book that I would have loved to have read when I was that age, because it might have made me feel a little bit better about all the astonishing thoughts and desires which were going through my head.
Do you think things have changed at all since you wrote it? This is another question from Lydia. She says, 9 years ago, teenagers seemed more innocent than they are in this generation. So doing it was a jolt awake that this is the way many teenagers talk and act. But do you think things have changed over the past 9 years?
Well, some things have changed and some things haven't. It's a change that this extract, for example, is coming out on the Guardian Children's website. Over the years, I'm openly invited to talk and to read from this book in countries like Germany and the Netherlands, very rarely in this country, in schools and so forth. And when you come across a teacher that has doing it on the shelves in their school library, it's always a pleasure and a little bit of a surprise to this day. And that debate about, and that fear of letting kids have access to this sort of book, and perhaps also the fear of the Daily Mail, dare I say it, and the headlines and the local newspapers and any bad publicity which might surround the book. Even though we all, I think most people who deal with young people or have had young people of their own know that this sort of thing is actually fine and it's not going to corrupt anyone, there are still a body of people, quite a small body of people, who object to it quite violently, and they do wield a lot of power in the classroom and in the library. And I think a lot of what we call the gatekeepers, which are the persons through whom books sometimes have to pass to get to young people, are very anxious more about those gatekeepers than they are about the books themselves. But amongst young people, I think there is more information. I think there's more honest and open information. Of course, the internet has blown away a great many myths, both in terms of information and of pornography and on all sorts of levels. The fact of the matter is, I suppose, that that transition from being a child who doesn't have any sort of sexual life to someone who does is still an interesting and sometimes funny and sometimes very frightening transition, and always will be, because it's part of growing up.
Margot, doing it is clearly a young adult book. It's been marketed as that. Tender Morsels is a bit more ambiguous. I mean, I understand in Australia it's an adult book, and over here it's been marketed with two different covers for adults and young adults. How do you feel about that? How did you feel when you were writing it?
Well, it came out first in Australia as an adult book solely. Then it came out in the US as a young adult book solely. And then it came out in the UK as both. And then the Australian YA edition came out. So it's had a bit of a mixed history. But I knew when I was writing it that it was in one of those markets, it was going to be young adult, and so there was only so much detail that I could put in. But in the end, there was only so much detail that I wanted to put in as well, because although the book does have quite a lot of sexual violence in it, the point of the book is not the sexual violence. It's not a book about rape. It's not a book about incest. It's a book about surviving trauma of any kind, really, and how you cope with how you live your life once you have been broken in particular ways, and how much you protect your children and how far you can protect them before your protection becomes a kind of abuse, because you're withholding them from experiences which will actually grow them up and turn them into real people. So what I did when I was writing the difficult scenes like the rape scene was do what I did in the extract that I read out, which ends there. You don't, after that scene, the scene stops there at the point where Fox says she's trapped. And then there's a section break, and then the next scene is a scene of her going down to the brook and washing herself after the rape and taking her baby with her. So you immediately know that she and the baby are at least alive and safe, but you know something terrible has happened. But I don't actually go into the detail of the attack itself, and I don't go into the detail of the attacks upon Liga by her father earlier in the book. I do actually go into quite a lot of detail about the miscarriages she suffers, which are part of her learning about how her body functions as well. For the first miscarriage, she doesn't even realise that that was a baby. Her father has purchased some abortifacient smoke from a witch and puts it in the fire, and the smoke gets into her system, and she has this miscarriage, and she thinks she's dying. She thinks her insides are falling out for no particular reason. And she doesn't even realise after it's all over that that was about a baby. And it's only in the course of the second miscarriage that she realises. So those things are... they're graphic in that they go through the sensations she's experiencing, but they're not graphically sexual. They're more about a sort of horrifying mystery that's happening to her through her body. But with the actual sexual violence, I tried to just sort of write to one side of it, or write up to a certain point and then stop and leave it implied. So the people with the worldly experience would know exactly what was going on and would supply all the details for themselves. But the people who didn't have the details at their disposal wouldn't have to actually go through that experience.
How effective do you think book covers are at signalling the content to readers? Because, you know, your book has been marketed with two different covers. Melvin, tell me about the cover of Doing It.
Yes, the cover of Doing It has a girl with her knickers on the way down. It shows her upper tops of her thighs, but no bottom or anything like that, just those legs. Now, that cover was presented to me, as publishers will do. They present it to you for apparent approval, but really it's not for apparent approval, because there's already been a huge panel of people deciding it, and it's just done. And my objection to it wasn't that it was sort of very graphic, because, you know, it's a graphic book, and it is actually about sort of people's attitude to sex and attempts to have sex and this kind of thing. So I didn't terribly mind that. I was a little bit put out that it was such a skinny girl. And I know there are a few people. I mean, someone said to me, she looks about 11. And one of the things I'd done in the book was to have actually quite a fat girl in there who was also very sexy, because I've got a bit of a thing about this whole body image business, and there's pressures on girls. So I was a bit disappointed about that, and I did point it out. It was far too late, because they'd done a number of shots using the same model, and that was all there was to it, really. I was very interested that that was picked by women, and in the American edition they had some etiolated, elongated girls frolicking on the cover as well, and that was done entirely by women as well. But obviously that cover is designed to grab and shock a little bit, and to also to describe what's in it. I mean, some of the comments I've had from it have been interesting. I had comments that it would put some people off reading it, because they wouldn't want that on the front, because they wouldn't want to advertise what they were reading. So clearly the cover does advertise what's in the book, perhaps a little too much for some people.
I wonder if they would actually have that cover, do that cover in the same way these days, because I think there is actually a lot more consciousness about the correctness of covers now in terms of race, and possibly in terms of that body image thing. They might actually be more inclined these days to reflect the context, to put the fatter girl's legs on the cover.
Well, you know, there was a large girl in there. There were also some ordinary girls in there whose sizes weren't described. I personally doubt it, really. Mm-hmm. I think that when they're making those decisions, they would feel that if they were to put a sort of fatter girl on, I think their reaction would be, it's a book about fat girls. Yeah. I think that's what they'd think, you know. Whereas if it's a thin girl, it's just a book about girls.
Yeah.
I kind of think that, really. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, you know, partly because, I say, it was done by women, there is still a widely held belief amongst practically all the women I know that thin is better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people still sort of glance at themselves in the mirror, and if it's sticking out a little bit, it's, oh, that's not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it's a bit flatter, that is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost universal amongst all the women I know.
But I'm intrigued that it's a book about boys' sexuality. It's a book aimed at boys. Do you think boys feel comfortable with that cover? I would have thought that a cover which featured boys would be more likely to signal to them that it's a book about them.
That's a very interesting point. I'm not really sure about that. I mean, it's perhaps worth pointing out that Margot was talking about how her book was marketed. Well, Doing It was marketed in this country as an adult book. Puffin can publish your book in various ways. They can publish it as a puffin with a puffin on the front. They can publish it as a puffin with a penguin on the front. Or, certainly in those days, they could publish it as a penguin, which meant that it went through the penguin sales team as opposed to the puffin sales team. And they were selling it directly to a different buyer in the bookshop. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know now, because they've decimated you know, sales teams so much. But it was part of a sort of boys and young men reading kind of campaign. I mean, put it like this, sort of magazines like GQ, if it's still going, and magazines for boys which are sort of soft porn, what do they call them? Men's interest magazines, those kind of things. They always have a girl on the front. They don't very often have a bloke on the front. They do occasionally, but usually there's a girl with him. So, you know, I think they were thinking perhaps of that sort of audience.
Margot, I've got a question from Danny, who is a Teen Site member, wrote a glowing review of Tender Morsels about a year ago, loves the book. And she'd like to find out how you felt writing about such strong themes. Do they relate to past experiences, or did you just feel they were important things to tackle?
No, they weren't. They weren't part of my personal experience that needed to be expressed. I always feel terribly coldly technical talking about this, because the traumatic scenes came from my looking at the fairy tale and trying to remake the fairy tale in a satisfying way. In Snow White and Rose Red, the mother and the two daughters live in this kind of enchanted ideal world, and I was kind of angry at the way this world was constructed. It seemed completely unreal. I wanted this perfection to be shown to be unreal, and I wanted the perfection to have come at the cost of something. So I decided that this perfect world in the forest where the girls, you know, the animals come to the girls and they live in perfect harmony with their mother, is actually the mother's personal heaven that she's been allowed because she has undergone so much suffering. She deserves this reward. Nobody can debate that she deserves this after all that she's gone through. And because the story seemed to be so much about the way women should relate to men and the way women should accept men, I decided that my story, the things that she went, Liga went through, had to do with the way that the world was set up, so that she had to relate to men in this way. So there had to be issues around sex and gender and the violence of one upon the other. They weren't in the writing of them. It wasn't particularly distressing because it's a different experience reading to writing, and sometimes you don't actually realise how powerful the stuff you're dealing with is because you've been so busy in the scene trying to calibrate it to evoke particular feelings, and you're working up very, very close, and you don't actually realise the full. Horrible thrust of a scene until you step back from it and you read it in reading time rather than writing time, which is very slow and very detailed, and it sort of takes a lot of the puff out of the scene. When you go back and you read it through, you realise, oh my god, that actually hits really quite hard.
Finally, these are both relatively old books for you both. For people who've enjoyed them, what new books from you can they look forward to?
Well, the one that's fresh out at the moment is The Brides of Roll Rock Island, which is a retelling of the Scottish Selkie myth about seals that come out of the ocean and turn into humans and are trapped on land by the men and women who love them. It's not as harrowing, I don't think, as Tender Morsels is, but it is extremely sad. So if you like a good weepy, you should definitely go for The Brides of Roll Rock Island.
And Melvin, what have you got out at the moment?
I've read The Brides of Roll Rock Island. It's a lovely book. I really loved it. I've done adaptations of myths and legends myself, and it's a really good go at that one. Well, the one that I've got out at the moment is, I do love working from fantasy from time to time, but I also love people's real stories. And whenever I meet people, I'm a bit of a thief, really, because I always try and question them, you know, what happened, and, you know, do you remember, and try and find out the story, because behind every face there's always a huge bundle of stories. And I got some real life, you know, you get the character, you get the situation, you get the story, you get the environment, you get the characters, you get the relationships, it's all there. So for my last book, which is currently out, Kill All Enemies, I talked to people who had been chucked out of school for one reason or another, and you find out that even though apparently they're just completely lost causes, actually they're really heroic, really, really quite heroic in other circumstances. So that's what's coming out. I've got a couple of books out next year, which is stupid because it means too much work. But I've got a horror story coming out with Hammer called Hunger, which I'm just finishing off now, and that'll be out in January. And I've got another very interesting one, which was a commission with The Chicken House, which is about a drug which gives you like a week of super youth, but you do die at the end of it. So, and the thing is there, what would your bucket list be? What would you do in that week? How would you live your last week at your whole life in a week? You know, just think what you'd dare to do, and just think what you'd force yourself to do, have to force yourself to do, because that's all the time you've got.
That sounds fascinating. When's that one out?
That'll be out in the spring of 2013.
Margot, Melvin, thank you very much. That was wonderful.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.